Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who has written a good deal about the history of America and also specifically about the history of religion in America. His name is John Butler. He's professor of American Studies, History, and Religious Studies at Yale University. He's visiting the campus here to give a talk. This is the Thulin Lecture. It is an annual event, the Thulin Lecture in Religion at the U of I. This is the event for 2009, and his talk will begin at 8 o'clock tonight in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. The title of his lecture is The Surprise of Religion in Modern America. It is free, open to anybody who would want to attend. So if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, certainly you should feel welcome. And just to explain the title a little bit, it was not all that long ago when a number of people, particularly important thinkers in fields of sociology and religion and psychology, predicted that particularly once we got into the 20th century and beyond, predicted that religion would die out. Now, of course, as we know, it hasn't. We know that religion is an important force in public life today. Certainly, it's important figures, importantly, in American politics. So that there are a lot of people who would say, well, maybe either the surprise is that religion has survived, or they would say, well, that's not surprising at all if you're paying attention to what was going on in American history. And I think that is the point that our guest would make. As we talk this morning, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, comments, people are welcome to call. We just ask that folks try to be brief so we can keep moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
And I think what you would say is, as I said, that, well, no, you wouldn't. One should not be surprised that religion continues to be important in America, and that if you were paying attention to what happened in the 50s and even before, you would say, well, no, it's not surprising. It never really went away, as some people said that it would.
Well, it's interesting because the main doubters about religion's possibilities in the 20th century actually were religious leaders, not just intellectuals, not Karl Marx, not just German sociologists, not just urban historians, but in fact American religious leaders. And they doubted it because they were deeply worried about the status of religion in American cities. They weren't sure that religion could make the transit from a rural face-to-face society to anonymous urban societies. They weren't sure that religion could really survive in industrial times. And many religious leaders actually worried about pluralism. That is, especially when they thought about the European heritage, and I'm speaking here particularly of the European heritage. Mm-hmm. Most Europeans had come from societies with relatively little religious diversity, and where there was a state church, and they were deeply worried, and it didn't really make much difference who they were. So Protestants in America were worried about the influx of Catholics and Jews at the end of the 19th century, and that it would destroy their hegemony over what they thought was America, Protestant America. They weren't really right about that, but that's the way they envisioned it. Catholics were worried about living in a society where the church wasn't supported by the state. So too were European Protestants who came from either Germany or Scandinavia. They didn't understand this new relationship. And Jews were worried in part because although they wanted to escape the shtetl, the enclosed, segregated villages of Jewish communities in Eastern Europe, they were worried about freedom, and Catholics were worried about freedom. What if people have choices about religion? They might exercise the wrong choice. So the interesting part of this is that it's actually religious leaders who were most deeply worried, and intellectuals also thought that they weren't really sure that this was going to work in what we would call modern times.
Yeah. What's really interesting to me is that if you take a look at the function that the church serves in people's lives and the role that it plays in the community, that this really helped, certainly, and it helped in the post-war period, maybe it helped before, to guarantee that religion would indeed have a future. And it's something that in other places that have strong Christian traditions, we just don't see. And that is the way that the church becomes the center of a community, an important place for goings-on, and not just religious goings-on, but social goings-on.
Well, you've hit on an exceedingly important point, and you've also hit on an American point, because, in fact, the kind of purpose that religion has tended to serve in the United States from the mid-19th century to the present is, in good part, one can make an exaggerated claim for this, but in good part, an American invention, in part because the church moved away from the state. In other words, in Europe, the church was an arm of the state. So the local minister or priest didn't really need to recruit his believers, in part because his salary and his duties, his salary was paid by the state and his duties were prescribed by the state. So the minister or priest in Protestant Catholic countries was someone who was an agent of the state. But in the United States, there is no state agency. There is no neither the priest nor the minister, to say nothing of the rabbi, has a salary paid. So they have to recruit listeners. They have to recruit participants. They have to recruit parishioners. They have to recruit synagogue members. And that act, that simple act, which is set in motion in many regards, at least in technical sense, by the First Amendment to the Federal Constitution, the last 16 words of which deal with religion, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibit the free exercise thereof, divorced religion from the state and set it on its own bottom, so to speak, and then, contrary to lots of fears at the time, religion actually prospered, at least in terms of formal relationships with religious organizations. But that's largely an American phenomena rather than a European phenomena.
Yeah. It's very striking, it seems to me, that every time some new wave of change comes along, religious leaders said, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to the church? In the sense that various waves of immigration, religious leaders said, oh, this is not going to be good. Increasing urbanization, people said, oh, this is not going to be good. When we get into suburbanization, people said the same thing.
Yes.
Oh, this is going to be the end of religion. And in fact, that it wasn't, because what happened when people moved to the suburbs, churches continued to perform that same community function. You know, it was not only the place where people went on Sunday. They were looking for all kinds of other things. Now, that might have, in some interesting ways, changed the church, changed the clergy. And we can talk about that. But again, it seems that with every wave of change, every new thing, religious leaders are saying, well, this is all over. This is the end. And then the church changed and met with that and maybe in some sense took advantage of that and continued to roll along.
Well, I think our religious leaders haven't been either any more optimistic or any more prescient about the future than anybody else. They haven't really, you know, they're almost as bad predicting the future as our economists. So they really haven't been terribly good at forecasting the future, and they have worried. They're kind of worry warts, and they haven't really. They've been just as sort of fearful as most other analysts. But the irony is that in the end, for example, take the question of post-World War II suburbanization. Post-World War II suburbanization utterly transformed the nature of American social life. And most of the denominations did stunningly good jobs about figuring out how they were going to find their place in the new suburbs. They really developed plan. They used techniques in planning that they had used in the cities to figure out where to place congregations, how many miles distant should one congregation be from another within the same denomination. Sometimes there was interdenominational, among Protestants, there was interdenominational cooperation, not always, but sometimes. They really did studies about where the population was going to go. They worked up financial models. How could congregations really succeed financially? They developed mortgage arrangements with banks to finance church construction. They actually did an outstanding job when it came time to do it. But that doesn't mean that several years beforehand they weren't fretting about how this was going to work out.
Yeah. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, John Butler. He's professor of American Studies, History, and Religious Studies at Yale University. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk, The Surprise of Religion in Modern America. That's the title. This is the Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture for 2009, Lecture in Religion, and he's going to be giving that talk tonight at 8 o'clock, the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum. It's welcome, open to anyone. Anybody's welcome to attend. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. At the same time that religion continues to flourish, I think some people would say that's an appropriate word, that churches as institutions do change, and I think that what people are looking for does indeed change. A more kind of full service institution, I think, is what they're looking for. That, I'm sure, places new kinds of burdens on clergy. That is, they are having to do things that maybe in the past they didn't do, or maybe not in such a formal way. So you end up having to have clergy trained in marriage counseling, for example, that maybe they didn't do before. Talk a little bit about how the the church changes in response to this increasing desire of people to have this broader range of concerns addressed.
Well, among American Protestants and later among American Catholics and among Jews, as you move from the late 19th century, the 1870s and 80s, into the 1920s and 30s, so across, say, that roughly half century, some fairly profound changes occurred in the way that all the denominations educated their principal leaders, their religious leaders, priests, rabbis, and ministers. And I suppose you could say two things happened. One is, and there is some criticism of this, obviously, the importance of theological education tended to decrease, not always in the same proportions, in all denominations. But tended to decrease. And what tended to increase was education in issues that had to do with the personal lives of parishioners, of synagogue members, of congregational members. And the symbol for that really is the rise of marriage counseling and counseling as part of the function of a priest, rabbi, or minister. And that efforts on counseling found themselves into the curricula of a variety of seminaries. I have to say probably Roman Catholic seminaries somewhat less than Protestant seminaries and Jewish seminaries, but by the post-World War II period, all the Catholic seminaries were doing the same thing. And it became a kind of lay version of secular, I'll say that, secular, not psychoanalytic techniques, but psychology. What are people concerned about? What causes their worry? How should their worries be addressed? To what extent does religion help them address their concerns? Does it help them see the future? Does it help them in their relationships with spouses? And some of the denominations actually promoted test taking, for example, among a couple wanting to get married. A minister would give them a test that had been worked up out of a seminary experience about, were these people really compatible? Did they have shared interests? And would discover, well, if they don't have shared interests, maybe they really ought to rethink their marriage. Now, that isn't a specific religious issue, but it becomes an issue, a real issue, in both counseling younger people about marriage, and then later counseling married people about problems in their marriages. And this becomes exceedingly important in the training of clergy. So I'm a historian, and among historians, the joke is, oh, all the seminaries got rid of their historians and they hired people who did marriage counseling. So we have a sort of occupational interest in this. That's not a fair accusation. But it is to say that the curricula of all seminaries changed significantly from the 1870s into the 1930s, and certainly by the 1950s and 60s.
Mm. When one thinks about significant developments in religion in the United States over the past, say, 20, 30 years, I'm sure the very first thing, and maybe the only thing that people will think of, is the rise and proliferation of Christians that call themselves born again or evangelicals, people who generally have a fairly conservative bent politically and who have organized very effectively to be a force in American politics. And I think that the point that you would make and other people would make is that while there has been a steady interest and participation in churches in the post-war period, that somehow this was so dramatic and maybe their involvement in politics was so powerful and so obvious that led a lot of people to say, wait, whoa, where did this come from? As if it came out of nowhere. But having said all that, though, what did make that possible? And is there something particular? Is there something interesting going on there, something unusual that led to a movement of people into these mostly Protestant, conservative, Bible-believing, evangelical, born-again kind of denominations?
You know, it's from a historian's perspective, so we could treat this, the rise of conservative Protestantism and especially born-again Protestantism, sort of like the way that historians treat the rise of the middle class. It's always rising. It's been rising since the 16th century, 17th century. And so we've had revival periods in the 18th century, had them in the 19th century, a series of revivals. Now we have them in the late 20th century. What's I think is surprising, certainly has been surprising for the press, for example, is that the press imagined America to be an increasingly secular society. And so the rise of the so-called New Christian Right, particularly most obviously in politics, led by Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson originally, now by many other groups, sort of runs counter to that. How can you have that? And so the question is, how could this occur? And it occurs for several reasons. One is, I think, that we misinterpreted the character of social patterns and religious patterns in America in the 20th century. We didn't pay a lot of attention to the fact that the actual commitment to religious congregations among adults was rising from the 1910s and 20s into the 1960s and 70s, not declining. And so we often imagine, oh, we're in a period of great religious decline. But in the 1970s and 80s and even in the 90s and now in the 21st century, more adults in the United States are committed to religious congregations than was true in the 1870s. And it's simply a statistical numerical fact because we actually, historians can actually track. You don't want to get into this, but we can actually, in a very boring way, we can go to any major research university library and look at the numbers. Denominations love to do their numbers. And we know how many seats, how many congregations, and we can compare that to the adult population. We can figure that out. So the question is, why is that happening at a time? It's because, I believe, among other things, denominations were really good at organizing. So there's an organizational effort going on here. The second thing, Americans are looking for meaning, and they find, and religion offers an avenue for finding out meaning, particularly in the post-nuclear world. That is, if you're going to blow everything up, what does all this mean? What does this mean after the explosion of the atomic and the hydrogen bombs? There was a great impulse in the 1950s to say, but in America, we want to preserve America from godless communism. And so there is an anti-communist element in some dimensions of this. And then there's the question of morality. And morality, religion is brought in the Civil Rights Crusade. Martin Luther King was, it's oftentimes forgotten. I think most of us who are historians are often startled by either reading about King or watching documentaries in which the fact that he's a preacher gets ignored. So we're interested in many things about Martin Luther King, including his sex life, but we aren't interested really in the religious background. There wouldn't have been a civil rights crusade without religious organizations in the United States. That is, Roman Catholic nuns marching and doing voter registration work in Mississippi and Alabama, Abraham Joshua Heschel marching with Martin Luther King in Selma. The great Heschel was the great 20th century America's greatest Jewish theologian, and huge support from a variety, wide variety of Protestant congregations. And then to say nothing about the use of black congregations in the South as modes out of which voter registration drives were held. So there's a reason that the Ku Klux Klan burned black congregations, burned their buildings. It was not only symbolic, but it also was literally physical. They wanted to destroy the congregation because they knew perfectly well that these people were working in the community to register voters. And then on the other side, by which I mean the other political side, because let's take that as a liberal politics, you get the rise of conservative Protestant political activity, with most obviously symbolized in Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. And they brought the whole issue of values and culture. What's wrong with American culture? Americans don't believe Americans ought to believe in the traditional family. Americans should believe in traditional marriage, personal behavior. And so, and that they see as part of the Christian heritage, and later they'll reinvent that a little bit and call this the Judeo-Christian heritage, though it took them a while to get the Judeo part into that formulation. That really didn't come until the early 1990s. So both the left and the right, so to speak, really employ religious language. And they ultimately employ religious organization. They ultimately employ congregations. And this has a profound effect, and you could see it in a new way in the Obama inauguration, and with the invocation and the benediction, representing two different political spectrums, but both of them involved in religion, and then you could see it in the Bush administration. I would say the Clinton administration tended to be, though Bill Clinton actually did a kind of very evocative religious, what should you say? Well, I'll use a word I shouldn't use, but in any case, they say lingo. Okay, so he could do that. The administration itself was really not so engaged in religious questions. Yeah. But Clinton knew. Put it this way: Bill Clinton was an expert at speaking in religious congregations, and he knew how to do this.
Well, I have a caller here. We're going to get right to, but I think that gets to the point that if you're going to be successful as a politician in America today, you must be able to do that. You're expected to be able to do that. And I would say, without fear of contradiction, that if you were an avowed atheist, I'm not sure it would be possible to be elected president today.
I think you're probably right. That's correct.
We have a caller I want to get right to. We're at our midpoint. Just to quickly introduce again our guest, John Butler. He's professor of American Studies, History, and Religious Studies at Yale University. He's authored a number of books, just to name two: Becoming America, The Revolution Before 1776. He's also co-author of the book Religion in American Life, A Short History. He's here to give a talk on the campus. This is the 2009 Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture in Religion. His lecture titled The Surprise of Religion in Modern America. That's tonight at 8 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. It is free and open to the public. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Bloomington, Indiana, the caller, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I understand another prophecy that the days of religion are numbered. That happens every so often. In fact, it happens quite regularly. And, of course, the religion they're talking about is Christianity. But actually, if you're willing to dig, there is more evidence than there ever has been of the validity of Christianity, mostly now because of end time prophecies. They are being so dramatically fulfilled, faithfully fulfilled, and of course focusing right on the Holy Land. The emphasis is right on the Holy Land. The first of these great prophecies, against all improbabilities, was that the nation of Israel was reestablished. And it continues to survive. The continued survival of Israel is just against all odds. And not only does it survive, but there's, as the Bible predicts it will, the people of Israel now are speaking what the Bible calls a pure language. They speak Hebrew. They speak ancient Hebrew. It was, when I was a boy, ancient Hebrew was just a liturgical language. No people actually spoke it except liturgically until Israel was reestablished. But now it's the living language of Israel. It's the same language King David spoke, and the Old Testament was originally written in. They speak it there, and it's against all odds. Incredible. Also, there's technology and weapons that were prophesied. You know, almost everybody knows about the prophecy that's called the Mark of the Beast. And if you didn't have that so-called mark, you wouldn't be able to buy or sell. That prophecy was absurd until computer chips, until barcode readers, you know, and in a cashless society. It's not absurd anymore. It's very credible. Also, the prophecy talks about dramatic events, which the whole world will witness at once. Everybody will see these events at once. That was absurd until satellite television. The Bible talks about weapons which will make tissue disintegrate. It talks about a war in which objects will be marked for later disposal, and it will take years to dispose of. That's a description of a radioactive battlefield, of a battlefield with radioactive residue. All those things are coming to pass. They were absurd before. In other words, as the modern world progresses, the evidence for the validity of this scripture becomes greater.
Well, okay. I don't know if you want to comment upon that or not, or whatever way you would like to comment on that.
Well, I think the caller raises one interesting point, perhaps inadvertently, but in any case raises an interesting point, and that is the degree to which many believers and many Americans are very actively involved in reinterpreting modern events according to biblical texts, and whether the text is the Christian Bible or the Hebrew Old Testament or the Quran or a whole variety of texts. The engagement of religion in modern times is often to make those texts Confucian texts. It makes the texts relevant to modern times. In some cases, they're quite literally, they can be literal efforts, but you notice that most of them involve reinterpreting the meanings of words. I would make just one slight comment, which I do with respect, and that is that I don't believe that, I don't think a linguist would actually argue that modern Hebrew is the same as ancient Hebrew. And so the languages are different, but even if we call them, just as we wouldn't say that Americans are in the 20th century speaking the same kind of English that our Puritan forefathers were speaking.
Yeah. Isn't it the case that even going back to the early days of the early Christian church, that people at that time thought it was only a matter of time before Jesus would be back, and that they were in fact living in the end times even then?
Well, it's absolutely true, yes. So the expectation for the second coming of Christ has been with us since Christ's death and resurrection, if you're a Christian and that's what you believe. And so that has fueled many Christian believers. Many Christian believers have believed that this is going to happen now. And, of course, in the 1840s, we actually had in the United States a movement. It was named after its founder, called the Millerite Movement, that actually predicted that Jesus was going to return in either 1843 or 1844. And that later morphed into when that didn't appear to have happened. Then that later morphed into the Seventh-day Adventist denomination, which moved which gave up the idea of predicting a specific date, but very much still emphasized the idea that sometime in the relatively near future, and the word near to be expanded, we're not quite sure what near means, that it would still be perhaps within 100 years or 200 years, something like this, but no specific date ever given.
Well, we certainly would invite other questions, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. And we've got some other folks lined up here. Let's go to Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, just a brief comment about the claims of the recent caller. Your guest said that the Hebrew of today is not precisely the Hebrew of the ancient world, and he's quite right. He might have gone a step farther and said that was not the language spoken by the Israelites for most of their history. They spoke either Aramaic or one of its kindred languages.
Well, all right. Very good.
That's correct.
And with that, we'll go on to another caller here. This is also Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Yes.
I wanted to ask the guest if he has seen the new survey that came out, I guess just today, or news of the survey came out, showing that religion affiliation has dropped among Christians 11% in a generation, and seems to go against what he's been saying, that religion is sort of increasing or maintaining itself in the USA. And then I had a quick follow-up question as to how the trends, you might expect them to go up or down over time. But just first about the survey.
I actually saw that in the USA Today when I was standing waiting for my flight to Champaign at O'Hare Airport. But I was in a hurry, and there was a big line to buy newspapers, and I didn't get a chance to read it, so I haven't. It's I'll just need to read it. Numbers go up and down, and we need to. I need to figure out exactly what the survey does and what it's saying, but so I can't actually answer your question.
You're referring to, this is the one that was done by Trinity College?
Right.
As I have in front of me here a quick release, and as a matter of fact, I was going to ask about this and see if you had some interesting things to say. Apparently here, according to this survey, the percentage of Christians in America, I'm reading off the press release, which declined in the 90s from 86.2% to 76.7%, has now edged down to 76%. Now, whether you consider that significant, you can argue about that. Also, apparently, the percentage of Americans claiming no religion, which jumped from 8.2 in 1990 to 14.2 in 2001, has now increased to 15%. So I indeed was going to ask some kind of question about, well, you know, what do you think about that, given that also we're told that the numbers of Americans who claim that religion is important over there in their life, that number seems to continue to go up. And according to the last things that I saw, it was really quite high.
One of the problems, I don't mean to be picky about this, but one of the problems of these kind of surveys is that you need to figure out exactly who they're talking to, how are they defining Christian, are we discussing membership in organizations or just personal feeling? And because I haven't seen this and it's just out for 72 hours or whatever, I really can't go at that. In some regards, if it's a public opinion poll, I'll say that these figures do go up and down. They also are oftentimes anomalous. That is, they have contradictory trends within them. So, but because I haven't seen it, I can't answer the question.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the other thing is, I've known many families where religion sort of, you know, disappears over time. So, you know, parents may have actually gone to a religious school and they lose their faith. And in those instances that I'm familiar with, the children are not religious. And if that's going to happen, if people become non-religious or lose a traditional religion and their children similarly, the only way that religion can be maintained is if children and people who didn't have any religion actually become religious. And is that actually happening? That I really haven't seen in my own personal experience. I see it going one way. I don't see it going the other.
Well, I think that if you were to ask clergy of almost any denomination about their many of their parishioners, particularly parishioners from roughly age 25 to 40, So in that, that's when they're typically having children. And you'll discover something. Most of them will tell you, well, yes, we have a number, any significant number of people within our congregation, whether it's Protestant, Catholic, or Jewish, or now Muslim, who themselves have mixed feelings about religion, but they're why are they here? Because they want their children to be trained in something. They want them to discuss these issues. As one of them, one of them has said to me, "Well, I really like it if my child stopped thinking of himself for at least a few minutes, could think about some larger issue." And there, this is a fairly common phenomena. You know, what does it mean about our patterns in general? Well, it certainly means that our patterns are voluntary in character, that there's relatively little formal compunction to do any of these things. At the same time, there seems to be an urgency to address questions about the meaning of life, about ethics and morals, what's right, what's wrong, and that religion has traditionally answered those questions actually to a considerable extent in American culture and society, and oftentimes claims to have the answers to those kinds of questions.
Okay, thank you very
much. All right, thanks. Just very quickly to stick with this kind of question, one of the things that you have said is that if you're an historian or a journalist or anybody else, you can go out, you can go to churches or to the denominations, and you can get there, you can find out how many people are signed up. You know, you can get the size of their congregations and you can come up with a number. And in fact, as you said, over the period of American history going back to the Revolution, the number of people affiliated with religious organizations has steadily gone up. Now, also people go out and conduct surveys and they go to door to door and they ask people, they ask, you know, depending on what kind of question they may ask, do you regularly attend services? Are you a member of a religious congregation? Or maybe they just say, would you say that religion is important in your life? Do you believe in God? You know, those kinds of things. And you get numbers much higher than the other number that you would think would be maybe a little bit more reliable indicator of religious affiliation. So you wonder, for those people who are responding to these pollsters, saying, yes, I believe in God. Yes, I go to church. Yes, I think this is very important. But they're actually not involved yes. in a church. You wonder, well, okay, what's going on here? Why are they giving that answer to the pollster? Does that reflect their true attitudes? Is it what they actually think they should be doing but aren't really? How do you account for that difference?
Well, I think a part of it is cultural. It's a well-known fact that almost every public opinion survey that asks the simple question, do you believe in God? And they ask that question in America, and then they go to Norway or Denmark and ask the same question. In America, 98 to 99% of all Americans will say yes. And they're only answering the question to a pollster either on the telephone or standing on their front doorstep. There isn't an audience standing around. In Norway and in Scandinavia, the answer is typically about 40% say yes, and somewhere the rest say somewhere between I'm not sure and no. And with the same privacy. So there's a different culture in America. There are also public opinion polls that say, that ask questions are, do you belong to a denomination? Do you belong to a religious organization? And the numbers are always higher than the actual membership numbers of the denominations. So some of the sociologists have jokes about that, saying that the denominations are out looking for these extra people who claim that they're Baptists or Presbyterians or Jews or whatnot, but they're not seen anywhere. Now, the question is, why do they say that? It's hard to say, because they may have some feeling about that. They may say, well, I'm really a Presbyterian, though it's true that I don't really go. I don't really belong. I don't really do anything. This is called culture. People have expectations that in their head that they may have had some training as a child. They may have gone to Sunday school. They may have been confirmed. And they still live with this, but they're not active. We would say they're not active believers, and if you emphasize the word active in that.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is John Butler. He is a professor of American Studies, History, and Religious Studies at Yale University, and has written a lot about American history and the history of religion in America. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. On to some other callers. Champaign County is next, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I recommend, I just heard an interview with Bart Erdman, who's much more mild than the other. There's this big atheist on the attack campaign, the Dawkins, et cetera. Bart Erdman came out of a very evangelical, I guess, even almost Dominionist kind of culture. And as slowly as he learned more, he's become now an agnostic, I guess. And it's a very interesting journey. So I recommend that for a future show. Other than that, I'm struck by this earlier caller, our regular caller from Indiana, who is so amazingly single-minded in his stance on Israel, for one. I mean, I was shocked to find out that Israel was actually a project, or that Zionism, Christian Zionism, was a project of Christians before it was even Herzl's atheistic Zionism from Europe was extant. I was absolutely astonished by that, but it predates the phenomena. So, but this right wing politics. Christianity that seems to get most of the press. I know it's not representative, but it is. I constantly wonder how important it is in some ways, because I think most of the problems in the world, political problems, are not religiously based if you actually look at them in essence. And so it seems to me that this is a bit of a digression, but I'm not sure, and I just wanted to know. I don't know where you come at this from in any way, but I'm very distressed by the Dominionist kind of point of view, and how, you know, the special forces. Jerry Boykins was going around, you know, saying that Islam is our God is bigger than their God, and Islam is the devil's religion, and all this stuff. I mean, all right. Well, I'm not very focused on this, but could you react to that a bit?
Well, in the last presidential campaign, there were a number of anti-Islamic sentiments expressed at a variety of points. I was struck myself by how fleetingly they appeared on the political scene given the possibilities of a much greater resonance. And they seem not to have had very much resonance in the last campaign. It's also intriguing to me that there's every reason to believe, though I think the voting studies, there are really not serious voting studies out yet done by political scientists, but it's probably true that Obama very significantly ate into the evangelical, what called the evangelical vote, in almost all states, maybe not quite everywhere, but in almost all states. But it's not always easy to figure that out, in part because the evangelical vote is itself very difficult to figure out. For example, where do you count African-American evangelicals? Should you count them as African-American voters, or you count them as evangelical voters? In California, in the recently, it's generally believed that Obama's success with Hispanics and with African-American voters also doomed the marriage, actually propelled the gay marriage amendment into being, because black voters and Hispanic voters appear to have voted overwhelmingly in favor of not supporting gay marriage. And so there was some warning about that in the week before the election. My point is very simple, is not to defend one or the other at all, but to simply say that many of these questions are much more complicated and then it seems, and it's the task of scholars and analysts to figure out in sophisticated ways where this stuff comes down and where does, quote, religion count and when doesn't it count.
Just real quickly, an earlier caller mentioned this recent survey. I'll give you my copy of the release here so
Great.
You can read. One thing I thought was really striking is that one of the things that they found was that the Muslim population of the United States, the proportion of the population continues to grow. Now, it's small. 0.3% in 1990, 0.5% in 2001, 0.6% in 2008. So again, that's small, but that is an uptrend. And I wonder if you think, you know, perhaps 5, 10, 20 years out, would we be seeing a significant proportion of the American population Muslim?
Well, so from a historian's point of view, minority groups have always, that's like the rise of the middle class, they've always been expanding. So we could track the same number of Catholics and Jews and whatnot. And our religious diversity has only gotten more complex. So my own answer to concerns about the rise of the Muslim population is that it's also equivalent to, you know, we have a large growth in Scientology. Mormonism was an infant religion a century and a half ago, now one of the world's larger religions, not by any means the largest. It's a very common thing. Part of this is really going to have to do with economics. Not that that has to do with religion, but the growth of the Muslim population in the United States is 98% of it is due to immigration. And the question is, if the world economy continues on its present path, we're not going to have a lot of immigration to the United States, just as it appears as though we have a decline in illegal immigration from Mexico, in good part because our economy is not in great shape, so there's no point in coming here. So it's not precisely a religious question. I would imagine that the Muslim population would grow, actually. Will it become as large as other groups, our Jewish population? Possibly. In part because our Jewish population is, depending upon how you define Jewish, that is, if it involves marriage to a Jew, for example, as opposed to something called secular Judaism, you know, it could be declining because there's so many problems within the Jewish population about intermarriage. So these are all completely fascinating questions, but I will tell you that historians are, again, I suggested earlier that religious leaders weren't great about predicting the future and worried too much. Historians are terrible about predicting the future, and you shouldn't believe anything that a historian tells you about the future.
All right. We'll try to get at least one more caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was wondering if you'd like to comment upon the thing that I see as one of the basic points of division in our nation. Regarding religion and politics, is the attitude by most persons who consider themselves people of faith with regard to science, and in particular, just to pick one thorny point, the debate between creationism and evolution and how that plays itself out. That's one of the reasons I don't count myself as a member of any religion and don't believe in God and so forth, is because there always seems to be this ongoing conflict, and also how that plays in, if you can, to the fact that, in at least in recent times in our nation, things seem to, politically speaking, things seem to come down to A and B, black, white, right, left, no middle ground, no center. You're either with me or against me, so on and so forth. There's no melding, you know, your team or my team, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder if you care to comment on that, please. Thank you.
Well, religion has sometimes very much been opposed to science. There are famous cases in the Roman Catholic Church or over Galileo and in Protestantism over the issue of stem cell creation, use of stem cells, to say nothing of other issues. It also happens to simply to be the case that that huge numbers, if I were to take you to Yale Science Department, which I wouldn't do for this particular purpose, but if I were to go out here to the University of Illinois Science Department, and we were to go one by one from scientist to scientist, I'm going to tell you that you're going to find a huge number of these individuals, I'll just do it without having actually done it, are going to be members of religious congregations. And they see no conflict at all. In fact, they would actually make the argument that their science is part of understanding the world. I'll put it in the way it's sometimes put. It's not my way of putting it, but it's the way it's sometimes put. Our science is here to figure out how God has created the world, how God has made this really astonishing, utterly astonishing creation. And they don't have any problem with an alleged conflict between science and religion. And so I think, in fact, that far too much is made of these polar positions, and not enough is – we don't investigate enough the much more malleable positions and interesting positions that are held by a whole variety of people on science questions and religious questions, and they don't see any conflict between religion and science, at least not a proper conflict between religion and science.
About 2 minutes. left. One of the things that you see, if you look at other industrial countries, particularly in Europe, that have been historically majority Christian, you compare them to the United States. There is, I don't think there's anything anywhere else to compare to the United States for the role of religion in public life as a current living sort of institution. It's just not there in Europe. Do you think that that's something that's and you know, maybe the numbers are going to go up and down and there'll be some interesting changes that, that people like you and me will talk about like this. But do you think that going forward that difference is still going to be there, and essentially the place of religion in American life is something that's not likely to change?
Well, I won't hedge a guess on the Europe-America thing, but I will say that America, what distinguishes our society? We are an idealistic society, and we are an idealistic people. And one of the reasons that religion appeals to Americans is because religion claims, sometimes rightly, maybe sometimes wrongly, to be able to articulate the nature of our idealism personally and nationally. And that's gotten us into trouble at some points. It's also helped us at some points. And I think that if you think about the nature of American society, that we imagine ourselves at least to be a highly idealistic society, it's not going to be surprising that religion is currently going to make a claim to be able to provide leadership and articulation on all the important public questions of modern life.
Yeah. Well, for those who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, John Butler, he will be giving a talk tonight. The title, The Surprise of Religion in Modern America. This is the 2009 Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture in Religion at the University of Illinois. Takes place at 8 o'clock. That's 8 o'clock tonight in the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum on South Gregory Street in Urbana. It's on the U of I campus. It is free, open to the public, sponsored by the Department of Religion. Anyone should feel welcome to attend. Our guest, John Butler, is professor of American Studies, History, and Religious Studies at Yale University. He is the author of a number of books, among them Becoming America, The Revolution Before 1776. He's also co-author of the book Religion in American Life, A Short History. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.